Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can we talk about how much you're getting paid? This year, in 22 states, workers are getting a raise. Some workers, anyway. That's because the minimum wage is going up. In California, it's $16 an hour. Make that 20 if you work in the fast food industry. Even more if you're in healthcare. Illinois workers are now taking home $14 an hour. In Montana, it's a charmingly specific $10.30. That is only a 35-cent increase, by the way, but hey, it's something. I called up David Newmark to help me puzzle out what this change means.
Think about it this way. We haven't changed the federal minimum since 2009.
David is an economist at UC Irvine. The minimum wage is kind of his thing. He's been studying it for 30 years. He says the first thing to know about all these adjustments to the American pay scale is that the shift here is, like a lot of things in our country, a compromise. With the federal minimum wage lingering at $7.25 an hour, states are getting involved. Cities and counties, too.
We have evolved into a system since the last federal increases and since we've gone now 15 years since then of essentially regional minimum wages.
10 million workers are reportedly about to benefit from this local economic boost. But I gotta say, when I heard that, it felt like whiplash. I still remember how controversial the idea of $15 an hour used to be.
We're gonna talk about the minimum wage, gentlemen. Mr. Vice President, we are talking...
This presidential debate was just 3 years back. At the time, candidate Biden was campaigning on the so-called Fight for 15. Then President Trump was not having it.
He said we have to help our small businesses by raising the minimum wage. That's not helping. I think it should be a state option. Alabama.
These days, I can't imagine a debate going down like this. Some Democrats seem ready to blow past the Fight for 15 and tell businesses to pony up even more.
This is Ask Governor Murphy, a co-production.
Take the governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy. Jersey's one of the states that hiked its minimum wage this year. And when Murphy showed up on a local call-in show to talk about it, he denied there was even room for disagreement about boosting pay.
I think the debate upon reflection, given what people get paid these days, is almost quaint, frankly. And I wonder whether or not we shouldn't be taking this higher. That's something that I'd be very open to. Haven't spoken to the legislative leadership about it, but I'm open-minded to taking this to another level at some point.
After hemming and hawing a bit, the governor floated the idea of an $18 an hour minimum wage, maybe even 20. Do you feel like the conversation about the minimum wage has fundamentally shifted in some way over the last couple of years?
Well, I feel like in the last couple of years, it's kind of disappeared. But I think it's become less of an issue in public debate. In large part because the labor market's been so hot and it's just not as big a deal for people anymore. It's not as big a deal for voters.
Today on the show, what the heck is happening with the minimum wage? And does boosting worker pay actually help the people we think it will? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I wonder if we can talk about how we got here with the minimum wage going up like this in at least like half the country. Maybe we should start with just how did the U.S. establish a minimum wage in the first place? Like, can you tell me that story?
In the earliest 1900s, there were a handful of states that passed minimum wages. Then the federal government in the 1930s passed a minimum wage for a narrow set of industries. And then slowly over time, two things happened. The level of the minimum wage rose, and it did early on, and later through the 60s, rise relative to wages. So it had more and more bite over time. And in some sense, more importantly, it was expanded greatly to cover almost all workers. There's a few exceptions at this point, but not very many.
And the minimum wage, was it always supposed to prevent poverty?
That's a good question. My awareness of people talking about minimum wages as a solution to poverty goes more to the 1960s or 70s when people really started to talk about this, and people still talk about that as a goal a lot. Earlier on, you know, the minimum wage was, I think some people argue, was meant to prevent competition from blacks or from women. You had black migration, of course, from the South to the North, entering manufacturing, which, you know, then and now are, you know, among the highest paying jobs. And if you had competition from folks that the people in power didn't like, and that would push down wages, well, if you pass a minimum wage, that's less appealing to hire the folks who will work for less. But I would say since we started talking about poverty, the war on poverty and all these things, the anti-poverty argument has come to the fore. I often quote Ted Kennedy, who was perennially a sponsor of higher minimum wages, as saying, I think erroneously, the minimum wage is one of the best, if not the best, anti-poverty policies we have.
How did raising the minimum wage become contentious? Like, my understanding is that the minimum wage, you know, it would be raised because costs would go up, but we haven't raised it federally since 2009. So when did that become a fight?
Oh, it's always been a fight. And I would say there are probably two groups that are the principal folks opposed. One is, of course, businesses who have to pay higher minimum wage, because why wouldn't they be opposed? Not all of them, but most or many. But economists also typically argued that the minimum wage distorts the labor market. And in particular, what it will do is price out the least productive workers.
What does that mean? Tell me what that means in like simple terms.
The only reason I, as a business owner, would hire a worker is because they will produce for me more than I have to pay them, right? The output they produce multiplied by the price I can sell it at, you know, in some simple way, has to be higher than the wage, or why would I hire them? No one's in business to lose money, because people are in business to make money. That's what they do. And when you raise the price of a subset of workers, and it, you know, obviously it's those whose wages would be at the low end, typically because of low skill, but not the only reason, you make those workers less attractive. And some of them may now be you know, sufficiently expensive and low productivity that employers don't want to hire them. The other angle, which is not necessarily related to productivity, is groups that suffer more from discrimination will be more adversely affected by the minimum. I mean, what does discrimination mean? Well, that's a complicated question, but the simple version to economists is I view the productivity of, let's say, a black worker as lower than a white worker, even if their, in a sense, physical productivity is the same. And then by the same token, if the government forces the wage up for them, I may be less likely to employ them. And you see some evidence of that in the data for minorities, that that minority job loss when the minimum wage goes up is a little bigger than non-minority job loss.
And I guess the other side of that is the argument that a rising tide boosts all ships. So if you raise the minimum wage, it's good for everyone across the board, right?
Right. There has been an argument made. I don't really hear it made much anymore. That somehow the minimum wage stimulates the economy and everyone does better. The only element of sort of potential truth in that argument is that the poor spend a higher share of their income than the rich, right? The poor don't save much. People with higher income save more.
So it's like a sugar rush for the economy.
In a sense, it's a sugar rush for the economy. But that effect is small. Those differences in how much we consume out of income aren't very large. And longer run, that's a bad thing because, of course, it's the savings that people do that ultimately finances investment, which ultimately makes workers more productive and is the reason we can now buy a lot more with an hour of work than we could 60 or 70 years ago.
If you've been listening closely, you can probably tell that decades of studying the minimum wage has made David Neumark something of a minimum wage skeptic, meaning he is not convinced that boosting worker pay is going to fix poverty. For instance, some studies show raising the minimum wage can mean fewer workers get hired in the first place.
Now, that doesn't mean minimum wages are a bad thing, right? Any government regulation you could name, I think, would cost somebody a job somewhere. If we get serious about climate change policy, oil refinery workers are not going to be happy. Then they're going to be worse off. The policymaker's job is to weigh the trade-offs. There's something we're trying to accomplish, like raising wages at the bottom, or maybe, we'll get to this in a minute, helping the poor. And we raise the minimum wage to do that. And if a lot of people are helped and a few are hurt, maybe that's a worthwhile trade-off. And that's where I think we come to the second issue that economists have studied, which is, does the minimum wage help people at the bottom? And the answer many people think is, well, it's got to, right? But empirically, it's not so clear. A lot of minimum wage workers or low wage workers are not the primary breadwinners in their family, and a lot of them are actually in quite high income families. So think about the teenager in an upper middle class family who has an after school job. There's no distributional reason we want to raise that family's income by raising the minimum wage.
You've also pointed out that people who are poor, like about half of them, don't work. So the minimum wage isn't going to reach them.
Right. The other main reason minimum wages don't help the poor much, if at all, is because if you take families, toss out the retirees, just look at those with working age adults, about half of them don't work at all. If you look back to the 40s or 50s, a very large share of that income that's in a sense mandated by the higher minimum wage goes to poor families, over half. As you come forward in time, you get to the 90s and the 2000s and the 2010s, it declines to well under 20%. It's worth thinking about what it means to say that of the increase in the wage bill from the minimum wage, less than 20% goes to poor families. That means that through the minimum wage, to get a dollar to a poor family, we have to effectively increase the wage bill employers pay by $5. That's a really inefficient way to get money to the poor.
You've done a little bit of this already, but I want to kind of come back to it. I'm mindful that what's happening now with 22 states boosting minimum wage is happening at this very particular economic moment. Like, a lot of things are going on at once. A couple years back, we saw this tightening of the labor market. Low wage earners seemed to feel really empowered. They were leaving their jobs. They were demanding higher pay. And then there was this inflation. People started feeling like the economy was bad, quote unquote, even though economists would say that's not so. How do these things play into what's going on now with the minimum wage in these states?
Well, I think the labor market has gotten very hot. You know, we have seen this repeatedly. We saw it in the late Clinton years. Again, we saw it in the mid-2010s. And of course, we're seeing it now. And that's the thing that lifts all boats. Or maybe that doesn't lift all boats. Maybe that's just all boats rising. You know, if you ask any labor economist, wherever they fall on the minimum wage debate, what's the best thing for low wage workers? I think they're going to say, and they sure as heck better say, a booming economy. right? The business cycle falls on low-skilled workers more heavily than on high-skilled workers, almost always, except some weird recessions. That's the context in which minimum wage increases are happening. So in a sense, you know, I think that's the sense in which they've become not irrelevant, but less relevant. And one can't point to the booming economy as evidence that the minimum wages didn't hurt, because the booming economy, of course, outweighs that.
Hmm. To me, I look at rising minimum wages around the country, and it seems a little bit to me like the least the government can do, by which I mean, when COVID was no longer a national emergency, we saw this clawback of all kinds of benefits that had been reducing poverty, things like the child tax credit and additional welfare resources and food benefits. Like, the government's spigot got cut off. And raising the minimum wage is something the government can do, where it's not footing the bill for it. Is that too cynical of me?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think we know inequality has gone up. Governments could do many things. They could give people checks. They could create policies, which we have, to create work incentives. You could have a child credit, which means maybe you get money if you don't work, but only if you have kids, or some version of that. But all of those are funded with taxes. And it's virtually impossible to create any new program that raises taxes. If you follow debates in D.C. about new programs, you always get them saying, well, and we're going to cut this one to pay for it. But the minimum wage is, it's not a free lunch for the rest of us, very much not so. Someone pays for it, but it's sort of a free lunch for legislators, and they can say they did something. I'll go one step further than you on the cynicism. I think you're right that it's a way to do something without having to essentially be responsible to taxpayers and voters. But also, I think we know, or we're pretty darn sure I am, and many others are, there are better policies that both encourage work and increase earnings at the bottom, but they have to be financed with taxes. And that's why the federal government, at least, has really shied away from them, except in an emergency.
After the break, so what about these better policies?
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
the great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
So what is your fix here, David? Like, instead of boosting the minimum wage, what would you be doing?
Well, we have a policy in place already that I would boost a lot more, and it's the earned income tax credit. And what it does effectively is it says if your family income is below a certain amount, and that amount depends on your kind of family structure, right? How many kids you have, you simply get a subsidy. With two kids from the federal government, if your income is below a certain level, and think of it as kind of high teens or 20,000 or so, you get a 40% extra check from the federal government. It's a huge subsidy. It's like a minimum wage increase of 40% in a sense, but it has some huge advantages. First of all, it encourages people to work because your take-home pay is now higher. Now, you might say, doesn't the minimum wage do that as well? Well, yeah, but when the minimum wage goes up, employers have to pay more to get you.
So they're less likely to hire you.
That's why there's job loss, right? When the EITC goes up, more people enter the labor market. The wage employers have to pay falls a little bit, so they hire more people, but workers' take-home pay is higher because they, of course, get this big subsidy from the government.
I hear what you're saying about a tax credit and why it's more efficient and why it's maybe more specific in terms of who it targets and who it helps. But it also seems complicated. Like, I know you're also a fan of this California tax credit, the California Competes tax credit, which incentivizes businesses to hire people. Like, basically, they tell the government, we're going to hire this many people if you give us a tax credit. And then the government can decide, like, we're going to give you that tax credit or not based on your application. All these things, though, they add these layers of bureaucracy. And it's not something that you would, like, campaign on. Like a tax credit that you have to fill out a form 3B and then you'll get a check in 3 months.
Well, the EITC is not complicated. The California Competes tax credit is. So policies can differ. So you're right. A tax credit that businesses apply for and then someone decides, and if they hire people, they get lower taxes, but then the government monitors to make sure you actually hired people and on and on and on. That's complicated. It might still work in that case. It does. The EITC is just a couple lines on your tax return.
But you still got to fill out that tax return.
Well, you're supposed to be filling out a tax return.
I know, anyway, but it's paperwork. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like, it's not as simple as, I don't know, as just a minimum wage hike where I just go get a job and the money comes.
No, that's true. That's true. But there are a lot of community organizations and others that help people fill out their tax returns. And, you know, look, that's the cost of a modern society. So I agree. It's a small cost to get the EITC. But I mean, I would turn it around and say, yeah, I agree. It is a little more complicated than the minimum wage. But in terms of getting income to low income families, at least when they can work, it's about as simple as it gets.
Yeah. I get the sense talking to you that the coming years will be really interesting for an economist to see how these booming minimum wages are actually going to play out. Are you kind of excited for the next few years?
It's always fun to be an economist. Despite it being the dismal science.
Spoken like an economist.
You know, this is where economists sort of feel a little tension. Because if you say, what's the best thing we could do with minimum wages for you as an economist and a researcher who wants to write and publish papers and figure out how the world works? It's, let's have a lot of crazy minimum wage increases, right, in different places. And especially in places where it's not because wages are going up, right, so it'll actually matter more. But then if you said, what would be the smartest policy? I'd say, well, we should probably argue roughly where we want the minimum wage to be relative to a location's wage distribution. You know, kind of how much bite do you want it to have? We should kind of have it roughly the same everywhere. So again, it'll be higher in California than in Alabama. And then we should probably index it to something, right? So that employers know what's happening.
Like inflation.
So it's kind of never going to sort of move around the price of low-skilled labor a lot relative to other workers. It's perfectly predictable to employers. So that's the tension. If I was advising a policymaker, I would say the latter, But that would make it less fun to be at least a labor economist who studied minimum wages, because there wouldn't be much more to do.
I mean, but as a scientist, are you like looking at all these states and thinking like, huh, I can't wait to see what happens in New Jersey, or I can't wait to see what happens in South Dakota?
Yes, definitely. If I could study, let's say, fast food restaurants in California and other restaurants in California, and one is affected by the minimum and what isn't, I'm pretty sure there's not much else going on that's driving demand for hamburgers at Burger King, but not at Five Guys. If I can compare what happens at the covered restaurants versus other restaurants in sort of the same price range that aren't covered by the law, then I can really isolate in a very compelling way the effect of the minimum wage. So even though it may be irrational, and I don't know why a guy who makes burgers at a fast food restaurant deserves a higher minimum wage than a guy who makes burgers at a bar, as a researcher, it's kind of cool.
David Newmark, I'm super grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
David Newmark is a professor of economics at the University of California, Irvine. And that's our show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. That's our membership program. If you go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus, you can find out all about it and sign up right now. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I will catch you back here next time.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.